The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is not uncommon today to find classrooms outfitted with iPads and digital projectors, which makes heavy textbooks seem that much more outdated. And yet, while more advanced technology does play an important role in education, the textbook industry has weathered the digital storm surprisingly well. Rachel Monahan is a contributor to the Hechinger Report, a nonpartisan online magazine that covers innovation and inequality in education. She recently wrote about how the textbook status quo is being threatened, not by tablets or ebooks, but by the rollout of the Common Core standards. And Rachel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So, Rachel, I'd like to start with some general figures. Now, we often hear about how big and influential the standardized testing industry is. How big is the textbook industry?
Well, for the K-12 or kindergarten through 12th grade market, which is what I wrote about, it's about a $7 billion industry, and it's dominated by three major publishers, Houghton Mifflin, Harcourt, McGraw-Hill, and Pearson Education. Mm-hmm. And all of them aren't just involved in textbooks. They do a wide variety of things in the education business, including, in some cases, standardized testing, like you mentioned before.
Thinking that 10 years ago, we may have predicted that digital textbooks would play a huge role in education. Not so much. Is it safe to say that the textbook industry has been slow to innovate?
I think the reason that there aren't electronic textbooks at this point has a lot to do with how many computers are available to students at public schools. But that doesn't mean there is an innovation happening as a result of Common Core, as I wrote about. The Common Core standards, which are designed to be new higher standards, which were adopted by more than 40 states across the country. They were supposed to make it easier for there to be higher quality textbooks because the textbook companies didn't have to worry about appealing to 50 different standards across the country, one for each state. They could concentrate on one set of standards. And so that was predicted to be good and easy for businesses to accommodate, both by supporters and critics of the Common Core standards. And my story in particular concentrated on the innovations that happened as a result of what was going on in New York State. What they wanted to do was put the materials online available for free, and that didn't interest the big publishers. They didn't want to do that. They still wanted to sell their products, for good reason. But what Common Core has done, it has opened up an opportunity for other people, teachers even, and in the case of what happened in New York, small organizations to get into position to provide what was a substitute for textbooks.
And the small organization that you're mentioning is Engage New York. Is that what you're referring to?
Engage New York is actually just the name of their website all of this is available for free.
Okay.
And there were four different organizations, three of them nonprofits, that ended up creating all of the curriculum materials for the website.
I'd like to bring in another voice. Eric Hirsch is founder and executive director of Ed Reports. Now, that's a nonprofit which evaluates textbooks. And a big part of what they are doing right now is assessing textbooks and seeing how aligned they are to the new Common Core standards. Eric, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
Now, Eric, how has the textbook industry stacked up so far in incorporating Common Core curriculum?
Well, we're early in our process in that we've only reviewed K-8 mathematics materials, and we reviewed 87 different textbooks, so 20 instructional series. What we found is only one of the series, which Rachel mentioned, nationally it's called Eureka, put out by Great Minds, but it's based on the Engage New York work, met all of our criteria for alignment with the Common Core standards. Other textbooks from the Big Three and other publishers partially met our criteria, and some met our criteria, for example, My Math from McGraw-Hill in grades 4 and 5, but only one made it for all grades K-8. And I do want to be clear that our standards for alignment are very high. We wanted to make sure it wasn't just that you could see the standard in the textbook or say this lesson teaches this. We look to really make sure the foundational elements of the Common Core, which make them different from New Hampshire and other states' previous standards, that they are much deeper and more focused, and that they really get at rigor. So when we say aligned in our book, that's a really high standard.
And so where are they falling down?
What we found is a lot of the materials we reviewed did not meet our criteria for focus. So we looked to see if they were teaching standards in grades before the Common Core said that they should be taught. And we looked to see if the majority of the textbook was focused not just on the standards, but kind of the seminal standards, major work of the grade, as they call it in the business, and found that many of the textbooks hadn't really moved from what had been there to this level of depth and focus.
So, Rachel, what does this mean for the legacy textbook publishers?
I think it remains to be seen. What it has meant is that schools have been using other materials. The inspiration for the story I wrote was I was in Houston at a school, and I was in a classroom where they had printed out materials from the New York State Department of Education website. So what's happening is that schools from all across the country that are following Common Core can get their materials from each other. There's a new kind of sharing that's possible.
Which is also threatening for textbook companies, because that'd mean a loss in profits, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
Well, Eric, there's been plenty of ideological divide, of course, over the Common Core. Any sense from you that legacy publishers, in not meeting the expectations that you, say, admittedly high, have set up, is it perhaps a deliberate decision by them to hedge a bit or cater to schools that are not embracing the Common Core? Or do you think it's a general inability to adapt quickly?
If I had to pick one of the two, I would definitely say it's more of the latter. I think when you think about what goes into a textbook, it's a lot of work. It's truly hard to put together a year-long curriculum series with scope and sequence, which is in part why there have been large textbook manufacturers out there. And I think when you look at the Common Core standards and how different they are than the 50-state standard landscape that have been out there before, revising a textbook to make sure it really gets at those standards takes a while and is complex. And I think a lot of the publishers are trying to add Common Core potentially onto the foundational elements of the textbooks that had been there prior.
Right. So tagging it on rather than fundamentally redesigning.
And there are a lot of factors into that decision. We are optimistic that we'll see more and more series that are aligned and really, again, get at the focus and rigor that the Common Core calls for.
So I'm not hearing from you that this is the death knell for the Big Three publishers.
First of all, 10 out of the 10 of the instructional series that we reviewed were put out by those big three. So they have a lot of products. Mm-hmm. And I think as they develop new products and revise others, they have a tremendous opportunity to make sure that teachers have what they need to teach these focused, rigorous standards. Part of why we're excited at Ed Reports by putting out our reviews, we hope that the big three and all publishers will move towards the standards we expect because districts and teachers will demand it.
Eric, in your opinion, who is doing the best job of providing those kind of quality teaching materials right now?
I don't know if the best question is the who is doing the best job or who's doing the job. And I think Rachel alluded to this, that more and more districts and educators are turning to within to create their own curriculum. And in talking with Mike Kirst, the chair of the State Board in California, about our work, he said, we're now expecting teachers not just to be chefs, but farmers. Hmm. And I thought that was really interesting. It's a different job, and not all teachers certainly have the time, if not the preparation, to not only teach, but really be creating units and really understand how to piece together these different units that make sure all of the standards are covered.
Yes.
So I think the most important thing is as teachers do more to bridge and adapt curriculum that the district may be buying, that we really help teachers with the professional development they need to do a great job with curriculum and teaching that curriculum.
The Common Core curricula, of course, very politicized over the past few years. The math standards have been particularly divisive for adults who don't recognize them. So how do textbooks fit into the partisan aspects of this issue?
Sure. I think for parents and the community at large, there's a need to unpack a few different things. So one is the Common Core standards themselves, which is really just what kids need to know and be able to do to be college and career ready. There's the curriculum, the textbooks, those supplemental materials, basically what teachers have at their disposal to get that those standards out. There's then the instruction from teachers. How do they take that curriculum and convey it to kids and differently to kids who are at different places? And finally, the assessments and the tests, no matter what stakes are attached. All four of those things are interrelated but different. And I think sometimes the frustration about any one of those four things gets put on the standards themselves. So I think for the textbooks, the key is we need to get teachers what they need to really convey these deep and rigorous standards to kids. But a lot of the more controversial questions we've seen out there are often generated from teachers who are doing their best to supplement the curriculum that's in their hands, mm-hmm. as opposed to the standards themselves.
Right. Eric Hirsch, their founder and executive director of Ed Reports. That's a nonprofit that evaluates textbooks. Eric, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Rachel Monahan, she reports on education and is a contributor to the Hechinger Report. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Now, there are links to read Rachel's article, How Common Core is Killing the Textbook, and also to the website for Ed Reports, both at wordofmouthradio.org. And today's lessons continue after a short break with a look at the rising price of college course materials. We'll also hear about the very first American textbook to see widespread use, the New England Primer. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard that big educational publishers are losing ground to a handful of nonprofits and upstarts when it comes to integrating new Common Core standards into textbooks for the K-12 set. Well, when it comes to college textbooks, it is the students who are feeling the squeeze. Producer Zoe Peterson reports.
As part of getting ready for class, many of us have to muster up the strength to deal with the sticker shock of our textbooks. The required reading that, according to the American Enterprise Institute, is rising in price faster than tuition, healthcare, housing, and inflation.
You have to, you know, wonder why college textbook prices are going up, and it can't be that the cost of publishing is going up because we see that the recreational book prices are actually falling.
That's Mark Perry, professor of economics at the University of Michigan, Flint, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and creator of the Carpe Diem blog. He offered a few possible answers to his own question.
One theory is that there's been a lot of consolidation in the industry, and so whereas there in the past might have been 15 or 20 publishers competing for that big market, now there's only three or four.
Beyond that, he says that the textbook market doesn't operate by standard market principles in the sense that there's no competition. Once a professor assigns a textbook, there's no alternatives. And with publishers printing new editions with minor changes every couple of years, the resale value of textbooks is lost. Despite the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008 that requires publishers to disclose the price of textbooks to professors when marketing their product, Professor Perry says that most instructors have no idea how much required materials will cost their students.
And it's often the case that professors are insulated from the cost of the book to the students because as professors, we deal with the textbook representatives and not necessarily really the bookstore. So when we're selecting a book or getting information on a new edition of a book, usually the price is never discussed.
Public Interest Research Group put out a report early this year analyzing how students have reacted to the ultra-expensive textbook norm. There were three major findings. First, the high cost of textbooks can deter students from buying required materials, as it did with recent University of Minnesota graduate Robert Andrade.
Sometimes you'd have to make decisions on what books they wouldn't buy, something you'd like maybe have to rent them from the library or borrow them or just not read them if, you know, you couldn't make it work.
Were you worried that it would affect your grades?
Yeah, but you gotta do what you gotta do, right?
The PIRG report also found that the rising cost of textbooks affected how many or which courses a student took, and that 82% of the students surveyed felt that they would do better in a course if there were a textbook available for free online. So here's what Robert Andrade suggests.
You can get an older copy, you can go to the library, or you can look online, hopefully for PDFs. Probably about a quarter of the time you'd be able to find something online.
And that piece was produced by Zoe Peterson. Well, so far today, we've heard about grade school and college textbooks. Now we look back to the very first textbook to see widespread use in the United States, the New England Primer. Well, to find out more about the Primer, producer Taylor Quimby spoke with Kyle Roberts. He's an historian and assistant professor of public history and new media at Loyola University in Chicago.
The truth is we don't have a copy of the original New England Primer. We just have references. And what we know is that sometime in 1683, a London printer named Benjamin Harris printed something that looks a lot like the New England Primers that we have today. In 1686, Harris fell afoul of the law and decided to flee to Boston. But it's not until about the 18th century that we actually have copies that survive.
So what, in terms of the contents, was the Primer teaching, and what did it use to teach?
Mm-hmm. It's a long book. It's 80 pages long, and it was aimed at small children. Although we have to keep in mind that literacy education happened at all stages, so there is evidence that adults were using it as well. Within the Primer, you would find the letters of the alphabet. You would find a syllabary, where they start to put letters together to make sounds. You would find spelling lists. You would find prayers, the Ten Commandments, morality tales. At the end of the Primer is a catechism in which students, young children, were expected to memorize answers to a very long series of questions. Today, I think most of us remember the New England Primer because it had a really quirky pictorial alphabet. If you've ever sort of heard the expression, in Adam's fall, we sin it all. In the Primer, we see the first sort of illustrations of that. It's a little image of Adam and Eve in the garden with a rhyming couplet that's connected to it.
So this was the first textbook in the sense that it was used by a lot of schools. Is that right?
Correct. Would have begun being used in the home. Then in places like New England that had a common school tradition, it would have been used there. By the 19th century, it was used in a lot of Sunday schools. I think its popularity is related to the sort of core materials that it offered. It sort of allowed somebody who knew how to read an easy book that they could use to teach other people how to read. It also came about at the time when printing started to take off. So its popularity is connected to the fact that printing was increasingly taking place in the North American colonies. So printers were looking for something they could sell. the primer was not something that fell under copyright. So they had an easy and popular work that they could quickly produce and sell readily.
And how long was it used for? When was it sort of replaced?
You know, a lot of people think that the primer is sort of a colonial or a Puritan document. In fact, its heyday of popularity was in the early 19th century. It's not until after about 1825 that its popularity really sort of declines. And it's around that time when technological changes, transportation, and increasingly secular culture is emerging, and books like McGuffey's Readers end up taking its place. But really, from the 1680s up through 1825, it was the leading textbook.
And do you know, is it available today? Do people use it today? Or is it really just a history lesson?
No, absolutely. It's still in print today. Wall Builders Press, which is run by David Barton, still publishes it. You can buy it on Amazon.com for $6.95. And it's, you know, who uses it's an interesting question. I think it's used in a lot of homeschooling. Historians use it. I use it in my classroom to teach students about how education worked in the past. What I have found in looking at over 400 editions is that the primer changed a lot over time. The primer that you might buy in 1805 in Philadelphia is going to look different than the one in Boston, than the one in Cincinnati or in Lexington, Kentucky. So the primer's sort of part of the primer's success is the fact that it can be adaptable for different audiences that might have different religious needs or different political needs or different cultural needs.
And that was historian Kyle Roberts speaking with Taylor Quimby. You can check out some pictures from the New England Primer at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, another odd history lesson. We're going to hear about the origins of the hashtag, or the pound sign, as it's sometimes called, or the number symbol, or once upon a time, the octothorpe. More hashtag weird history when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Symbols are designed to be adaptable. And our next story from Roman Mars of the 99% Invisible podcast looks back at the origins of a symbol that has taken on new meaning in the social media age.
If you've been online recently, you've probably seen that little symbol that looks like a tic-tac-toe board. You might know it as a hashtag.
In the current digital world, the hashtag identifies movements, events, happenings, brands, topics of all kinds.
Producer Avery Truffleman.
It's getting to the point where the hashtag is erasing the symbol's other uses.
In the States, it's usually called the number sign or the pound sign. In the UK, it's often called a hash mark.
This is Keith Houston. He's the author of a book called Shady Characters, The Secret Life of Punctuation, Symbols, and Other Typographical Marks. It's got a whole chapter on this symbol.
And it has a lot of other random uses as well. It's used in chess to represent a move that results in checkmate. In proofreading, if you see a hash symbol, this means a space should be inserted here. It's used on Swedish maps to mean a lumber yard.
Hash, pound, number sign, lumber yard, whatever you want to call it, however you want to use it, the symbol traces back to ancient Rome.
So in Rome, the term libra pondo meant a pound in weight.
And these two names were interchangeable, so Romans referred to this weight measurement as a libra or a pondo.
So the word libra was often abbreviated as LB.
Lowercase L, lowercase B. And oftentimes, it was drawn with a little bar across the tops of both letters, just to show that the L and the B were connected.
Scribes, or writers, got a bit careless, so they'd write faster and faster and faster, so you join the L to the B, and then maybe the pen doesn't leave the paper before it does the little bar across the top. And so this seems to have given rise to the pound symbol.
Or hash mark, or lumber yard.
But it was important enough to wind up on typewriter keyboards.
Fast forward to 1963, the invention of the touch-tone telephone. The touch-tone phone used buttons instead of a rotary wheel. Bell Laboratories, a research subsidiary of AT&T, experimented with a few different designs for the telephone keypad, but they ended up arranging the numbers 1 through 9 in a 3x3 grid, and they put 0 alone in the bottom center.
Years later, in 1968, they figured, why not add keys to either side of the 0? This would give users a few more options on the phone menu.
To repeat these options, press the star key.
Originally, Bell Labs wanted pretty shapes on the two extra buttons. They had made prototype phones that had a five-pointed star and a diamond on either side of the zero.
But an engineer named Doug Kerr would have none of this diamond and five-point star business.
Because by that time, a new thing had come into the picture, the possibility of customers dialing directly from their phones into a computer for such things as checking bank balances or validating their credit cards or what have you.
Doug Kerr wanted to make sure that the two new symbols would be ones a computer could recognize, ones that appear on a keyboard and were part of the computer's vocabulary.
Bell Labs was pretty set on their star and diamond idea. So the compromise was an asterisk for the star and a pound for the diamond.
And for a second, AT&T was like, can we at least call it a diamond?
It's not a diamond at all.
AT&T didn't know what to call this button in their manuals, and this led to the creation of what some people, including Keith Houston, consider the symbol's official name.
The Octothorpe.
The Octothorpe.
One day I was out with my engineering partner, and we got to talking about it and thought maybe we should come up with a new name.
This is Lauren Asplund. He worked in marketing for AT&T during the time. He and his engineering partner looked at the symbol and saw that it had eight lines sticking out of it.
So we'll put the word octo in there, and then just out of thin air, we just said, well, we'll put the word therp, T-H-E-R-P, in there too, because that sounds kind of Greekish and gave it some stature.
They called it an octotherp, but that morphed into Octothorpe.
The manufacturer, Western Electric, totally hated that name and pretty much killed it in the 70s. But today, for a lot of type aficionados, Octothorpe is the sign's real name.
Whatever you want to call it, the symbol has gone from the written page to typewriter keyboards to phone keypads and will probably stick around.
And our thanks to Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible for that story. And if you enjoy surprising histories, well, you're going to love what's coming up next. When Word of Mouth continues, a self-described surprisologist talks about the benefit of not knowing what's coming next.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A lot of people say that they hate surprises, and it's little wonder given that our daily agendas are so packed, requiring a kind of efficiency, discipline, and borderline control freakery to stay on task and get it all done. So we follow our schedules and GPSs and seek out predictive technologies to eliminate the unexpected from our lives. In a new book, self-described surprisologists Tanya Luna and Leanne Renninger urge us to interrupt our lives with surprises. Preventing the unknown is futile, after all, and together they argue that shifting our perspective on surprise can open us up to more creative, interesting, and far less boring lives. The book is called Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. And co-author Tanya Luna is with us, researcher, psychology instructor, speaker, and co-founder and CEO of Surprise Industries. Tanya, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. I'm so delighted. Word of mouth and surprise go hand in hand, actually.
Well, that's kind of what we're going for here, so thank you very much for joining us. A person who say that you used to hate surprises, now you specialize in them. So can you tell us about that transformation?
Yeah, so I very much started out life, I think, being the exact opposite of what I am now. I really tried to keep the surprises out of my life. I think probably not by nature, but just because of a lot of kind of unpleasant surprises, a lot of change and uncertainty in my childhood, I learned as a coping mechanism to be a control freak, essentially. I would try to prevent surprise by planning things, by, you know, always being one step ahead. And I really loved surprising other people. I just didn't like being surprised myself. Mm-hmm. So my sister Kat and I started a company called Surprise Industries, and the idea is that you sign up for an experience and you don't know what it's going to be until you get there. So for me, it was really being inspired by my business to then start researching surprise and the psychology of surprise and understanding how to apply it to my own life.
Well, so you were becoming comfortable with surprises while your co-author, Leanne, she worked in the lab and she kind of admits to having a surprise deficiency in her life, which led her to study experimental psychology. She studied reactions of human beings to surprise, among other things, and among her findings, surprise probably has evolutionary underpinnings. What can you tell us about that?
From an evolutionary standpoint, surprise is basically what we've evolved with to pay attention to dangers and opportunities.
So our ancestors passed on these genes to us that really enable us to get the most out of our environment. So every time we're surprised, we plug into the moment. It's like a pause button that gets us to focus on what's happening right here in the present. Mm-hmm. And it allows us to get curious. It's the learning mechanism in our brains. So when we're surprised, we learn. And then it's also the word of mouth spreading, sharing mechanism of basically what happens is when we're surprised, we have this cognitive burden. So we have this urge to talk about it. And that most likely is something we've evolved to do as well.
Do other mammals experience surprise?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, surprise, even fish. I spoke with a researcher who studies fish. I said, do they experience surprise? And he says, yeah, you know, you see in some ways a very similar reaction with other animals. Used to surprise my dog all the time. There's this stop moment, this freeze experience where they're just completely for about 1/25th of a second, this blank slate that are just trying to take in what's this thing that's going on that's different from what I expected. And then if it's a pleasant surprise, you see the intensification of emotion. So, you know, you can YouTube dogs getting surprised, and there's some really delightful videos out there of animals experiencing this just increased joy of, for example, someone coming home.
And I love how you describe it, that moment of surprise, that instead of, you know, bulging eyes and jaw agape, you call it the duh face.
Exactly. Yeah. So most human beings think that when we're surprised, our eyes bulge and our mouths drop open. Actually, what research shows is that that's more likely the face we use to communicate surprise to others. When we're genuinely surprised, we have no self-awareness. And so we just kind of look like, again, like someone just pushed the pause button. It's just like, duh, nothing's happening. It's like the loading screen, you know, cognitively speaking. And I love that facial expression. It looks so dopey, but it's so genuine, and it means that we're completely in the moment.
I want to go back to that evolutionary aspect that, you know, the saber-toothed tiger appears, oh, I'm surprised, I run away kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about creating more of that in our life, this unpredictability, this moving out of our comfort zone. But it makes me wonder, you know, that's kind of an adrenaline rush. And is all that surprise good for you to always be kind of like on?
No, definitely not. That's a really good point. So if you're in a constant state of surprise, that could lead to anxiety, it could lead to PTSD, you know, as surprise and PTSD go hand in hand. So you want to have ideally the right balance of surprise. Mm-hmm. So you want to, we think about it as like, it's like a surprise seesaw. So on the one side, you have not enough surprise, and that leads to boredom, it leads to disengagement, low creativity, less learning. On the other side, if you have too much surprise, that leads to anxiety. So what you want to be doing is just thinking strategically about surprise. Where do you need more stability, routine, tradition, and where do you need more mystery, anticipation, unexpected moments?
Tanya Loon is all about creating those unexpected moments. She is a researcher, psychology instructor, and co-author of Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. And there are exercises at the end of every chapter of the book to, as you put it, exercise your surprise muscles. So let's go through some of those, some practical applications. Say you're planning a vacation. How would a surprisologist approach it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, the natural urge is to plan everything, especially with Google at our fingertips. You could look at reviews, you could look at photos. But then the downside is you planned out this perfect vacation. Even if everything goes well, you're really not experiencing that much emotion because it's what you predicted. So ideally, you don't want to Google away delight. You want to leave, let's say, about 50% of it open to serendipity. Or maybe you have a partner that you're going on vacation with and you take turns plotting little surprises for one another. I think, you know, practically speaking, it's doing little things like making sure that you leave room to talk to the locals, wherever it is, even if it's just a different town. So building those kinds of moments into your vacation give you a lot more bang for your buck, basically.
Well, how about a partner? In a long-term relationship, things can become a little stale and routine and predictable. What can we do to shake that up a little? And you can give us the G-rated version, please.
Sure. Well, you know, it depends very much on your personality, but you can go with something as simple as just keeping a log of all the things your partner mentions that he or she wants and then randomly surprising them with gifts. You know, you could do little things like if it's like my husband and I, we have days that, like, I clean the kitty litter on odd days. He cleans the kitty litter on even days. And occasionally we'll surprise each other by just cleaning the kitty litter on the wrong day. It's so simple, you know, but you're like, oh, you know, he cares about me. We're plotting lovely things for each other. And then you can get more elaborate. You know, we do all kinds of ridiculous things. We think of our home as like a surprise laboratory. So we like to plot little surprises for one another when we get home, whether it's like yesterday I changed the light bulb in our bathroom from like a regular light bulb to it's like a rainbow colored light bulb. It's so silly, but it just keeps us on our toes and gives us something to laugh about, to connect over and to reminisce about, which is also, you know, research shows being able to laugh about your memories together is one of the best predictors of relationship satisfaction.
Well, I have to say we're very pro-silly in our little show pod. But, you know, so much of the book is about developing resilience and flexibility and vulnerability that comes with being open to surprises, which, of course, are not always good. Surprise can be a terrible shock. It can be a disaster. So how do we approach these really unpleasant surprises over which we have absolutely no control?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, in thinking about surprise, we can't just talk about like the delightful aspects of it. We know surprise intensifies emotion by about 400%, which goes for positive and negative surprises. So it can really shake us up. For me, one of the things I like to think about is surprise, negative surprise in particular, being one of our best teachers. So really taking those moments as opportunities to learn about ourselves, to learn about what's important to us. So I think shifting into thinking of those negative surprises as learning opportunities is critical. But there's a few other things you could do when there's a negative surprise that happens. One is turn to the things in your life that are not surprising. So again, balance it out by turning to people that you can trust, finding routine and comfort. But then also finding ways to reframe. So looking at the situation and saying, okay, you know, this is genuinely bad, and I'm allowing myself to feel these really sad or hurt or angry emotions. But on the other hand, nothing is all bad or all good. So how can I reframe this and find what's good about this?
Interesting moment to be talking about surprise, especially you talked about the surprise seesaw, and there's almost this push-pull that we have with technology and surprise. On the one hand, we have big data, we have algorithms, detailed weather maps, predictive models that give us a sense of what is to come. Are you asking us to let go of that?
I think that it's just about being mindful of how much of predictive technology we use. You know, I think a lot about us versus like an animal at the zoo. If you were to interview an animal at the zoo and say like, hey, do you want to just hang out and nap all day and I'll just bring you food and you don't have to hunt, the animal will be like, yeah, that sounds pretty good. But what ends up happening in reality is when you don't have human animals and non-human animals, when we don't have that uncertainty, the variety, the unpredictability, you see the shift in our mood and our health, and we're just not as active, we're not as healthy, we're not as engaged, and, you know, that feeling of aliveness is lost.
Tanya, is there in your mind the best surprise that you ever pulled off?
I think one of my favorite surprises that we did at Surprise Industries was we had the school contact us about a teacher who was retiring. She had been in an accident and was actually paralyzed from the neck down, but she was still teaching, and the school just absolutely loved her, but she had to retire. And so they asked us if we could come up with a surprise for her, and it wasn't in New York. We're in New York City, and it was far away, so we were thinking, okay, we love this story. We want to figure something out. What we ended up coming up with was she was kind of an adrenaline junkie, which is really tough when you're paralyzed.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, you don't feel like yourself. But we realized that she can actually take a flight lesson where she could fly the plane herself. And so we set her up with this lesson. She flew over the school. The entire school came out holding up signs for her. So she got to fly over the school and just see all this love coming from her students. And, you know, her reaction was just really incredible. And I'm so grateful for the school coming together and you know, inviting us to be a part of that.
Oh, that's a beautiful surprise. Thank you so much, Tanya, for joining us.
Thank you.
Tanya Luna is CEO of Surprise Industries, and she also leads the culture department of Life Labs New York. She and Life Labs founder Leanne Renninger are co-authors of Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. There's more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
If
you woke up one day to find out you'd been promoted, well, that would be a surprise, right? Our next story of a surprise that shocked the nation comes to us from Andrew Parsons, producer for Backstory with the American History Guys.
One night in 1841, John Tyler rose from his bed to find out the President of the United States was dead.
He was apparently awakened at around 4 o'clock in the morning.
This is Francis Tyler, or
Francis Payne Bourknight Tyler. I'm from Mulberry Hill Plantation, and I married Harrison Tyler.
So you would be the granddaughter-in-law of Tyler.
Well, I'd never thought of it that way, but I think I am.
Anyway, the news was a big deal because Tyler had been sworn in as William Henry Harrison's vice president just a month before. Over the course of those 30 days, Harrison had succumbed to pneumonia. Tyler hadn't even moved to D.C. He was still in his home in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Tyler took no chances. He immediately dressed and went to Washington and promptly had himself sworn in.
Now, anyone in this position would have been in a rush. But Tyler had even more reason to be panicked. No president had ever died in office, meaning no vice president had ever become the president before. And this is important because the language in the Constitution is kind of vague about what to do in this situation. Basically, it says if the president dies or resigns or is unable to, quote, discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same will devolve onto the vice president, unquote. Michael Gerhardt is a constitutional law professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He says no one really knew exactly what that meant at the time.
The question becomes, what does the words the same mean there? Do they mean the duties? Do they mean the office? Do they mean both? That language was vague, and a lot of people up until then disagreed over what that language really meant.
The first thing Tyler did was meet with Harrison's cabinet, who were calling him acting president. But Tyler had a different idea. He was a lawyer and a political veteran who put forth his own interpretation of the Constitution.
He said to them, I am not the acting president. I'm not the vice president acting as president. I am actually the president of the United States.
Tyler took an oath of office and issued an inauguration speech. But this didn't win him any allies in Congress. The opposition party, the Democrats, had hated him ever since he left them back in the days of Andrew Jackson. His new party, the Whigs, stood in principle against a strong executive and thought Tyler should carry out Harrison's intentions. Tyler was suddenly in the position that nearly any action he took was interpreted as executive overreach.
The attacks begin early and they happen often throughout his 4 years in office. He has one of the most heated and intense 4 years in office of any president in history.
Let's go through the highlights. First, there was the name thing. The House and Senate immediately started pushing through legislation that would officially call Tyler vice president. People called him acting president, vice president acting as president, and most stingingly, his accidency.
And you can find letters that were addressed to Tyler with all those different sort of forms of addressing him, and he basically never responded to anything other than Mr. President or President Tyler.
And then there was Henry Clay. He was the powerful Speaker of the House, was leader of the Whigs, and had run for president himself more than a few times. He quickly met with Tyler, assuming that as acting president, Tyler would be sort of a pushover.
Turns out Clay was dead wrong. Within a very short period of time, actually only a couple meetings, the two men were yelling at each other.
And he said, you, Mr. Clay, handle your end of the Capitol Street, and I, by God, will handle mine.
It became clear to Clay at that point, my gosh, Tyler's going to become his own man. Tyler actually thinks he's president.
Which, of course, he was. Within just a few months, Clay organized the Whigs into kicking Tyler out of the party entirely. He became known as the president without a party. And then there was the rest of Capitol Hill. Congressmen were enraged whenever Tyler tried to set his own agenda. Their tempers flared each time Tyler vetoed a bill or nominated his own choices for cabinet. A move that was necessary since nearly all of his cabinet resigned over the vetoes.
So Tyler's got battles every direction he looks, to the point where there are three different impeachment attempts against him over the course of those 4 years.
But despite all this acrimony, Gerhardt says the power of the presidency was actually strengthened by the standoff across Pennsylvania Avenue. Every time Congress blew up over a veto, or Tyler nominating his own men, he took pains to defend his actions.
For each one of these exercises of power, Tyler issues what are called protests or proclamations, which are all thought to be really excellent legal documents in which he's explaining the powers of the presidency. And he's doing this to the party, the Whigs, who believe the president should be weak. And each time he does it, it's like a nail in the coffin of the Whigs, because he's saying to them, your philosophy doesn't hold water. The president needs to be powerful, powerful enough to stand on his own 2 feet against the other branches.
And Tyler won in the long run. First, he set the precedent of what happens after a president dies, that the vice president not only assumes the duties of the president, but becomes the president. But even more, Tyler's vision of a president who works with Congress instead of having his strings pulled by Congress won out.
And that piece was produced by Andrew Parsons. So grateful for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including your way to subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.